If you are able to remain on your object for 4 hours vividly and continuously, you have achieved firm stability. Unfavorable states of body and mind are gone, and a bliss of physical and mental pliancy is attained. At that point, you have achieved calm abiding. To be endowed with calm abiding, the mind must have the stability to hold fast to one object. But this alone is not sufficient. The mind must also be clear. But this too is not enough. Its clarity should be intense, alert, and sharp. The mind cannot be even a little dull. These fine adjustments to the mind that make it susceptible to calm abiding are not easily accomplished. In Dharamsala, India, one of the Tibetans practicing concentrated meditation told me that the cultivation of one-pointed concentration was worse than imprisonment in a Chinese jail. Because it is difficult, it is important to prepare carefully, moving from step to step. Do not push yourself too hard, especially at first. Otherwise, you run the risk of becoming upset or even having a nervous breakdown. The goal here is daily practice, where you choose an object of meditation, and as you focus on it, try to achieve and maintain stability, clarity, and intensity. Calm abiding can also be achieved through daily meditations on the mind itself. One of the advantages of observing the mind now is that it will strengthen your ability to manifest the mind of clear light as you are dying. First, identify the mind's essential nature of luminosity and knowing, unsullied by thought, and then concentrate on it. This is one among many levels of thoughtlessness. I will describe meditation on the ultimate nature of the mind later. To prepare for concentrating on the mind itself, you need to overcome emotional obstacles by engaging in the accumulation of positive merit, such as through developing compassion, as discussed earlier. The next step is to become familiar with the nature of your own mind. The best time for this is early in the morning, just after waking, but before all your sense faculties have become active. Your eyes are not yet open. Look at or within consciousness itself. This is a good opportunity to experience the clear light nature of the mind. Do not let your mind think on what has happened in the past, nor let it chase after things that might happen in the future. Rather, leave the mind vivid, without any constructions, just as it is. In the space between old and new ideas, discover the natural, unfabricated, luminous, and knowing nature of the mind, unaffected by thought. When you remain this way, you understand that the mind is like a mirror, reflecting any object, any conception, and that the mind has a nature of mere luminosity and knowing, of mere experience. After you recognize the nature of the mind as luminosity and knowing, stay with it. Using your powers of mindfulness and introspection, remain in that state. If a thought comes, just look into its very nature, and the concept will lose its power and dissolve of its own accord. Sometimes, through exertion, you can prevent a thought from fully forming. More likely, though, when you reach this state of recognizing the basic, unaffected, unfabricated nature of the mind, thoughts will dissolve as soon as they form. And even when they do come, they will not be powerful. Know that just as the waves of the ocean are made of water, thoughts are made of the luminous, knowing nature of the mind. And through continual daily practice, thoughts will weaken and disappear without any other exertion. This practice of meditation itself sharpens your mind and improves your memory, qualities that are certainly useful beyond spiritual practice, whether in business, engineering, raising a family, or being a teacher, doctor, or lawyer. This practice also helps on a daily basis with anger. When you get irritated, you can concentrate on the nature of the anger itself and thereby undermine its force. Another benefit of such mental training emerges from the close connection between body and mind. When you are young and physically fit, your mind is powerful. It is particularly valuable to begin training then, so that as you age, your mind stays fresh and positive through the body's changes. After all, the human brain is a special endowment, and it would be a pity to let it weaken through neglect, surrendering its powers to age until, animal-like, its only job is to take care of the body. For practitioners, early mental training, and especially concentration on the mind, is important preparation for the final day, when your mind must remain clear and sharp to make use of the special techniques during the stages of death, or at least to influence rebirth into the next life. Dullness of mind at this critical point can be very dangerous. A real guarantee for a good rebirth is to be able to conduct your practice during the stages of dying. Your state of mind just before rebirth is influential in determining the character of your next life. You may have accumulated great merit in your life, but if you leave it with a dull mind, you jeopardize the form your next life will take. On the other hand, even if you committed some regrettable deeds in your lifetime, when the final day comes, if you are prepared and determined to use that occasion to the fullest, your next rebirth will definitely be good. Therefore, strive to train the mind to be fresh, alert, and sharp. In difficult situations, it is easy to become emotionally worked up. Buddhism offers many techniques for relieving stress and finding calm in the trying situations we face every day. These techniques vary according to the situation and the person. It is particularly effective to use the power of analytical meditation to address problems directly rather than trying to avoid them. Here are some examples of this technique. When you are confronted with trouble, do whatever you can to overcome it. But if it is insurmountable, then reflect on the fact that this trouble is due to your own actions in this or a previous life. Understanding that suffering comes from karma will bring some peace, as it reveals that life is not unjust. Otherwise, sorrow and pain might seem to be meaningless. Initially, a problem can seem solid and intractable until you investigate its true nature. To do this, work at understanding the range of suffering in your own life. Ordinary mind and body have a nature of suffering, just as it is the nature of fire to be hot and burning. In the same way we have learned how to work with the nature of fire, we can learn how to work with suffering in our own lives. Consider trouble from a broader perspective. If someone accuses you, rather than lashing back, imagine that this accusation loosens the chains of your own self-cherishing and thereby enhances your ability to care for others. Reframe bad circumstances as forces assisting your spiritual development. This technique is difficult to implement, but very powerful when you succeed. When you are jealous or wish harm on an enemy, instead of stewing over that person's bad qualities, reflect on his or her good attributes. Most people are a mixture of good and bad qualities. It is hard to find anyone who is bad in all respects. Reflect on the emptiness of inherent existence. This is the deepest analytical meditation and something I will explore shortly. Or you can use stabilizing meditation for a temporary rest. If you cannot stop worrying over something in the past or what might happen in the future, shift your focus to the inhalation and exhalation of your breath. Or recite this mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. Since the mind cannot concentrate on two things simultaneously, either of these two stabilizing meditations will cause the former worry to fade. It seems to me that all religions could benefit from Buddhist meditation techniques. Single-minded concentration could be applied usefully in many situations. In all walks of life, we can benefit from focusing the mind and increasing memory. Summary for daily practice. Choose an object of meditation and focus your mind on it. Try to achieve and maintain stability, clarity, and intensity. Avoid laxity and excitement. Alternatively, identify the fundamental state of the mind, unsullied by thought, in its own state, mere luminosity, the knowing nature of the mind. With mindfulness and introspection, remain in that state. If a thought arises, just look into the very nature of that thought. This will cause it to lose its power and dissolve of its own accord. Part 4. Practicing Wisdom. Examining how beings and things exist. To generate the type of love and compassion that motivates you to seek Buddhahood, not for yourself, but for the sake of others, first, you must confront suffering by identifying its types. This is the first noble truth. From the time we are born to the time we die, we suffer mental and physical pain, the suffering of change, and the pervasive suffering of uncontrolled conditioning. The second and third noble truths lead us to understand the causes of suffering and whether or not those causes can be removed. The fundamental cause of suffering is ignorance, the mistaken apprehension that beings and objects inherently exist. Now, as I will show, beings and objects do not, in fact, exist this way. We all have a valid, proper sense of self, or I, but then we additionally have a misconception of that I as inherently existing. Under the sway of this delusion, we view the self as existing under its own power, as established by way of its own nature, as able to set itself up. This sense of inherent existence can even be so strong that the self feels independent from mind and body. For instance, if you are weak from sickness, you might feel you could switch bodies with someone who is stronger. Similarly, when your mind is dull, you might feel you could switch your mind with someone else's sharp mind. However, if there were such a separate I, self-established and existing in its own right, it should become clearer and clearer under competent analysis as to whether it exists as either mind or body, or as the collection of mind and body, or as different from mind and body. In fact, the closer you look, the more it is not found. This turns out to be the case for everything, for all phenomena. The fact that you cannot find them under such analysis means that those phenomena do not exist under their own power. They are not self-established. Sometime during the early 60s, when I was reflecting on a passage by Tsongkhapa about unfindability and the fact that phenomena are dependent on conceptuality, it was as if lightning coursed within my chest. Here is the passage from Tsongkhapa's text. A coiled rope's speckled color and coiling are similar to those of a snake. And when the rope is perceived in a dim area, the thought arises, this is a snake. As for the rope, at that time when it is seen to be a snake, the collection and parts of the rope are not even in the slightest way a snake. Therefore, that snake is merely set up by conceptuality. In the same way, when the thought I arises in dependence upon mind and body, nothing within mind and body, neither the collection, which is a continuum of earlier and later moments, nor the collection of the parts at one time, nor the separate parts, nor the continuum of any of the separate parts, is in even the slightest way the I. Also, there is not even the slightest something that is a different entity from mind and body that is apprehendable as the I. Consequently, the I is merely set up by conceptuality in dependence upon mind and body. It is not established by way of its own entity. The impact of my reflection on this statement lasted for a while, and for the next few weeks, whenever I saw people, they seemed like a magician's illusions in that they appeared to inherently exist, but I knew that they actually did not. That experience, which was like lightning in my heart, was most likely at a level below completely valid and incontrovertible realization. This is when my understanding of the cessation of the afflictive emotions as a true possibility became real. Nowadays, I always meditate on emptiness in the morning and bring that experience into the day's activities. Just thinking or saying I, as in, I will do this, will often trigger the feeling. But still, I cannot claim full understanding of emptiness. A consciousness that conceives of inherent existence does not have a valid foundation. A wise consciousness, grounded in reality, understands that beings and other phenomena, minds, bodies, buildings, and so forth, do not inherently exist. This is the wisdom of emptiness. Understanding reality exactly opposite to the misconception of inherent existence, wisdom gradually overcomes ignorance. Remove the ignorance that misconceives phenomena to inherently exist, and you prevent the generation of afflictive emotions like lust and hatred. Thus, in turn, suffering can also be removed. In addition, the wisdom of emptiness must be accompanied by a motivation of deep concern for others and by the compassionate deeds that that compassion inspires. This is necessary before wisdom can remove the obstructions to omniscience, which are the predispositions for the false appearance of phenomena, even to sense consciousnesses, as if they inherently exist. Therefore, full spiritual practice calls for cultivating wisdom in conjunction with great compassion and the intention to become enlightened, in which others are valued more than yourself. Only then may your consciousness be transformed into the omniscience of a Buddha. Both Buddhists and non-Buddhists practice meditation to achieve pleasure and get rid of pain. And in both Buddhist and non-Buddhist systems, the self is a central object of scrutiny. Certain non-Buddhists who accept rebirth accept the transitory nature of mind and body, but they believe in a self that is permanent, changeless, and unitary. Although Buddhist schools accept rebirth, they hold that there is no such solid self. For Buddhists, the main topic of the training in wisdom is emptiness or selflessness, which means the absence of a permanent, unitary, and independent self, or, more subtly, the absence of inherent existence, either in living beings or in other phenomena. To understand selflessness, you need to understand that everything that exists is contained in two groups called the two truths, conventional truths and ultimate truths. The phenomena that we see and observe around us can go from good to bad or bad to good, depending on various causes and conditions. Many phenomena cannot be said to be inherently good or bad. They are better or worse, tall or short, beautiful or ugly, only by comparison, not by way of their own nature. Their value is relative. From this, you can see that there is a discrepancy between the way things appear and how they actually are. For instance, something may, in terms of how it appears, look good, but due to its inner nature being different, it can turn bad once it is affected by conditions. Food that looks so good in a restaurant may not sit so well in your stomach. This is a clear sign of a discrepancy between appearance and reality. These phenomena themselves are called conventional truths. They are known by consciousness that goes no further than appearances. But the same objects have an inner mode of being called an ultimate truth that allows for the changes brought about by conditions. A wise consciousness, not satisfied with mere appearances, analyzes to find whether objects inherently exist as they seem to do, but discovers their absence of inherent existence. Such a wise consciousness finds an emptiness of inherent existence that is beyond appearances. Emptiness or selflessness can only be understood if we first identify that of which phenomena are empty. Without understanding what is negated, you cannot understand its absence, emptiness. You might think that emptiness means nothingness, but it does not mean nothingness. Merely from reading, it is difficult to identify and understand the object of negation, what Buddhist texts speak of as true establishment or inherent existence. But over a period of time, when you add your own investigations to the reading, the faultiness of our usual way of seeing things will become clearer and clearer. Buddha said many times that because all phenomena are dependently arisen, they are relative. Their existence depends on other causes and conditions, and depends as well on their own parts. A wooden table, for instance, does not exist independently. Rather, it depends on a great many causes, such as a tree, the carpenter who makes it, and so forth. It also depends upon its own parts. If a wooden table or any phenomenon really were not dependent, if it were established in its own right, then when you analyze it, its existence in its own right should become more obvious, but it does not. This Buddhist reasoning is supported by science. Physicists today keep discovering finer and finer components of matter, yet they still cannot understand its ultimate nature. Understanding emptiness is even deeper. The more you look into how an ignorant consciousness conceives phenomena to exist, the more you find that phenomena do not exist that way. However, the more you look into what a wise consciousness understands, the more you gain affirmation in the absence of inherent existence. Lust and hatred are ruled by ignorance, and so cannot be generated limitlessly. Since, as we have established, when any phenomenon is sought through analysis, it cannot be found, you may be wondering whether these phenomena exist at all. However, we know from our own direct experience that people and things cause pleasure and pain, and that they can help and harm. Therefore, phenomena certainly do exist. The question is how they exist. They do not exist in their own right, but only have an existence dependent upon many factors, including a consciousness that conceptualizes them. Once they exist, but do not exist on their own, they necessarily exist in dependence upon conceptualization. However, when phenomena appear to us, they do not at all appear as if they exist this way. Rather, they seem to be established in their own right, from the object's own side, without depending upon a conceptualizing consciousness. When training to develop wisdom, you are seeking through analysis to find the inherent existence of whatever object you are considering, whether this be yourself, another person, your body, your mind, or anything else. You are analyzing not the mere appearance, but the inherent nature of the object. Thus, it is not that you come to understand that the object does not exist. Rather, you find that its apparent inherent existence is unfounded. Analysis does not contradict the mere existence of the object. Phenomena do indeed exist, but not in the way we think they do. What is left after analysis is a dependently existent phenomenon. When, for example, you examine your own body, its inherent existence is negated. But what is left is a body dependent on four limbs, a trunk, and a head. Whenever we think about objects, do we mistakenly believe that they exist in their own right? No. We can conceive of phenomena in three different ways. Let us consider a tree. There is no denying that it appears to inherently exist, but we could conceive of the tree as existing inherently in its own right. Or we could conceive of the tree as lacking inherent existence. Or we could conceive of the tree without thinking that it inherently exists or that it does not inherently exist. Only the conception of the tree as existing inherently is wrong. The tree does not inherently exist in its own right. It is right to conceive of the tree as lacking inherent existence, and it is also right to conceive of the tree without thinking either that it inherently exists or that it does not inherently exist. Even though the modes of apprehension are right in these two types of conception, the mode of appearance is still mistaken in that the tree appears as if inherently existent. If objects do not inherently exist, does this mean that they cannot function? Jumping to the conclusion that because the true nature of objects is emptiness, they are therefore incapable of performing functions such as causing pleasure or pain, or helping or harming, is the worst sort of misunderstanding, a nihilistic view. As the Indian scholar Yogi Nagarjuna says in his precious garland, a nihilist will certainly have a bad transmigration upon rebirth, whereas a person who, albeit wrongly, believes in inherent existence will go on to a good transmigration. Allow me to explain this. You need a belief in the consequences of actions to choose virtue in your life and discard non-virtue. For the time being, the subtle view of the emptiness of inherent existence might be too difficult for you to understand without falling into the trap of nihilism, where you are unable to understand that phenomena arise in dependence on causes and conditions, which we call dependent arising. For the sake of your spiritual progress, it would be better for now to set aside trying to penetrate emptiness. Even if you mistakenly believe that phenomena inherently exist, you can still develop an understanding of dependent arising and apply it in practice. This is why even Buddha, on occasion, taught that living beings and other phenomena inherently exist. Such teachings are the thought of Buddha's scriptures, but they are not his own final thought. For specific purposes, he sometimes spoke in non-final ways. Because all phenomena appear to exist in their own right, all of our ordinary perceptions are mistaken. Only when emptiness is directly realized during completely focused meditation is there no false appearance. At that time, the dualism of subject and object has vanished, as has the appearance of multiplicity. Only emptiness appears. After you rise from that meditation, once again, living beings and objects falsely appear to exist in and of themselves. But through the power of having realized emptiness, you will recognize the discrepancy between appearance and reality. Through meditation, you have identified both the false mode of appearance and the false mode of apprehension. Let us return to the central point. All of us have a sense of I, but we need to realize that it is only designated depending on mind and body. The selflessness that Buddhists speak of refers to the absence of a self that is permanent, partless, and independent, or more subtly, selflessness can refer to the absence of the inherent existence of any phenomenon. However, Buddhists do value the existence of a self that changes from moment to moment, designated depending upon the continuum of mind and body. All of us validly have this sense of I. When Buddhists speak of the doctrine of selflessness, we are not referring to the non-existence of this self. With this I, all of us rightfully want happiness and do not want suffering. It is when we exaggerate our sense of ourselves and other phenomena to mean something inherently existent that we get drawn into many, many problems. Summary for daily practice. As an exercise in identifying how objects and beings falsely appear, try the following. 1. Observe how an item such as a watch appears in a store when you first notice it. Then, observe how its appearance changes and becomes even more concrete as you become more interested in it. And finally, observe how it appears after you have bought it and consider it to be yours. Second, reflect on how you yourself appear to your own mind as if inherently existent. Then reflect on how others and their bodies appear to your mind. The Middle Way. Buddhist texts tell us that upon realizing emptiness, the illusion of inherent existence weakens. But this is unlikely after a single brief realization. If you have not attained one-pointed concentration, that is to say, calm abiding of the mind, you cannot use mere understanding of emptiness to uproot the illusion of inherent existence. Rather, you need to engage in analysis again and again. Through concentrated meditation, your mind will become strong, deep, stable, and capable of one-pointed concentration on emptiness. This will gradually work to diminish grosser levels of the misperception of reality. This is the reason why Buddhist sutras, as well as the three lower tantras, all say that calm abiding is a prerequisite for special insight, or, in another way, that concentrated meditation is a prerequisite for wisdom. The stabilizing meditation used in calm abiding and the analytical meditation used in special insight are not differentiated by the objects of meditation. Both could have either emptiness or conventional phenomena as their focus. The difference is that observing emptiness from within a state of calm abiding requires physical and mental suppleness induced through stabilizing meditation on emptiness. Whereas special insight, observing emptiness, additionally involves physical and mental suppleness induced by analytical meditation with respect to emptiness. That degree of suppleness can only be gained after attaining the easier level of suppleness produced by stabilizing meditation. Therefore, you need to achieve calm abiding before special insight. Although calm abiding could be achieved through taking emptiness as its object, this is only for practitioners who have already understood emptiness. Usually, however, practitioners first achieve one-pointed meditation and then gain the view of emptiness through reasoned analysis. All Buddhist schools agree that the analytical reasoning process, which leads to an inference, this being a conceptual realization, derives from basic, shared, direct perception. As an example, let us consider this reasoning. A plant does not inherently exist because of being a dependent arising. You begin by reflecting on the fact that a plant is a dependent arising because its production depends on certain causes and conditions such as a seed, soil, sunlight, and water. But eventually, the reasoning process must be supported by direct perception, or it cannot stand. We can see with our eyes that plants change. They grow, mature, and finally dry up. In this sense, inference is blind, since it must eventually rely on direct perception. Inference depends on reasoning, which in turn rests on basic, shared, indisputable experience through direct perception. Knowable objects can be divided into the obvious, the slightly obscure, and the very obscure. In order to understand a very obscure topic, it is necessary to rely on scripture. But even for this type of inference, it is not sufficient just to cite one scripture as validation for another. Rather, you must analyze whether there are any internal contradictions among scriptures on that topic. You must also analyze whether there is any contradiction between what the scripture says about that topic and what is evident in direct perception. Beyond that, you must analyze whether there is any contradiction between what the scripture says about that topic and what can be understood through basic inference derived by reasoning. So, even in these very obscure cases based on scripture, analysis is needed. Buddha set out 4 steps for establishing reliability. 1. Do not rely just on the person, but rely on the doctrine. 2. With respect to the doctrine, do not rely on just the words, but rely on the meaning. 3. With respect to the meaning, do not rely just on meaning that requires interpretations, but rely on meaning that is definitive. And 4. With respect to the definitive meaning, do not rely on just dualistic understanding, but rely on the wisdom of direct perception of the truth. Buddha also said, like gold, which is chosen by a goldsmith upon being scorched, cut, and rubbed, my word is to be adopted by monastics and scholars upon analyzing it well, not out of respect for me. In the process of reasoning, it is very effective to state absurd consequences of wrong views in order to overcome the potency or vibrancy of that wrong idea and then make a proof statement. When I was studying logic as a youth, a scholar once told me that both in debate with a Buddhist who asserts inherent existence and in your own analytical meditation, it is a rather soft approach to use a syllogistic statement such as, my body is without inherent existence because it is a dependent arising. However, it has more impact to use an absurd consequence such as, it follows that my body could not be a dependent arising because it inherently exists. This is because it is fundamental to Buddhism that all phenomena are dependent arisings. Buddha himself, in setting forth sutras, and Nagarjuna and his spiritual sons, Aryadeva, Buddhapalita, and Chandrakirti, in commenting on the meaning of those sutras, use the fact that phenomena are dependent arisings as the final reason for establishing emptiness. This indicates that phenomena in general are not non-existent and that impermanent phenomena are fit to perform functions. When Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, first he identified true sufferings, sources, cessations, and paths. And then he said, sufferings are to be recognized, but there is nothing to be recognized. The sources of suffering are to be abandoned, but there is nothing to be abandoned. Cessation is to be actualized, but there is nothing to be actualized. The path is to be meditated, but there is nothing to be meditated. The meaning of this is that although there are factors among the Four Noble Truths to be conventionally and validly recognized, abandoned, actualized, and meditated, there is nothing to be ultimately recognized, abandoned, actualized, and meditated. From the viewpoint of ultimate reality, all of these are beyond activity. Everything has the same taste in the emptiness of inherent existence. In this way, Buddha set out the perspectives of the two truths, conventional truths and ultimate truths. All phenomena, causes and effects, actions and agents, good and bad and so forth, merely conventionally exist, only nominally exist. They are dependent arisings. Because phenomena depend upon other factors for their existence, they are not independent. This absence of independence or emptiness of inherent existence is their own ultimate truth. You will come to comprehend this emptiness of true existence when you become dissatisfied with mere appearances and you use analysis to probe beneath the surface. When you thoroughly understand appearance and emptiness, you will also understand that they are in harmony with one another. Appearance does not preclude emptiness, and emptiness does not preclude appearance. Failing to understand this, you might believe in virtue, non-virtue, cause and effect, and so forth, but then be unable to believe in emptiness. Similarly, you might think that you understand emptiness, but then be unable to believe in the facts of cause and effect, help or harm, pleasure or pain that arise dependent upon conditions. Without proper understanding, emptiness and appearance seem to prohibit each other. However, phenomena are empty of inherent existence because they depend for their existence on other conditions. And conversely, phenomena are capable of functioning because they are empty of the solidity of inherent existence. If phenomena were not empty of inherent existence, if they did exist by their own power, then they could not be affected by other causes and conditions. They would not change. In that case, they would not cause pleasure and pain, help and harm. Good and bad would be impossible. Full realization of dependent arising brings with it the double understanding of appearance and emptiness of inherent existence. The extremes of utter non-existence and inherent existence are simultaneously cleared away by this twin understanding. Knowing that phenomena arise prevents believing in the extreme of nihilism, since it allows objects and beings to function in this world, allowing for the cause and effect of karma. Knowing that phenomena are dependent also prevents believing in the extreme of inherent existence by eliminating that phenomena exist in their own right. Through understanding these two truths, you arrive at the middle way. What is the relationship between objects and their emptiness? This profound topic is addressed in a scripture on the perfection of wisdom called the Heart Sutra, which is recited and meditated daily throughout great vehicle Buddhist countries such as China, Japan, Korea, Mongolia, Tibet, and Vietnam. It is a short and pithy presentation by Buddha about the wisdom required to overcome problems at their root, and, in conjunction with an other directed motivation and compassionate deeds, to attain the omniscience of a Buddha. Here is the Heart Sutra in its entirety. Homage to the supramundane, victorious perfection of wisdom. This is what I have heard. At one time, the supramundane victor was residing together with a great community of monastics and a great community of bodhisattvas on Vulture Mountain in Rajagriha. At that time, the supramundane victor was absorbed in the concentrated meditation of the enumerations of phenomena called perception of the profound. At that time, the bodhisattva, the great being, the superior Avalokiteshvara, also was observing the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom, and was viewing even these five aggregates, forms, feelings, discriminations, compositional factors and consciousnesses, to be empty of inherent existence. Then, through the Buddha's power, the Venerable Shariputra said to the Bodhisattva, the Great Being, the Superior Avalokiteshvara, "How should a child of good lineage, who wishes to practice the profound perfection of wisdom, train?" The Bodhisattva, Great Being, the Superior Avalokiteshvara, replied to Shariputra, "Shariputra, sons or daughters of good lineage who wish to practice the profound perfection of wisdom should view phenomena as follows. They should correctly and thoroughly view even these five aggregates as empty of inherent existence. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is not other than emptiness. Similarly, feelings, discriminations, compositional factors, and consciousnesses are empty. Shariputra, in that way, all phenomena are empty, without characteristics, not produced, not ceasing, not defiled, not separated from defilements, not decreasing, not increasing. Therefore, Shariputra, in emptiness there are no forms, no feeling, no discriminations, no compositional factors, no consciousness, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no forms, no sounds, no odors, no tastes, no tangible objects, no other phenomena. In emptiness, there is no eye constituent through to no mental constituent, and through to no mental consciousness constituent. In emptiness, there is no ignorance and no extinguishment of ignorance, through to no extinguishment of aging and death. Similarly, in emptiness there are no sufferings, sources, cessations, and paths. No exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Therefore, Shariputra, since bodhisattvas, the great beings, have no attainment, they rely on and reside in this profound perfection of wisdom. Their minds are without obstruction and without fear. Having thoroughly passed beyond error, they go to the finality of nirvana. Even all the Buddhas in the past, present, and future become manifestly and completely awakened into unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment in reliance on this profound perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom is the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra of thoroughly pacifying all suffering. It should be known that since it is not false, it is true. To state the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, Tadyata gatte gatte para gatte para sangatte bodhi swaha. It is thus, proceed, proceed, proceed beyond, thoroughly proceed beyond, be founded in enlightenment. In that way, Shariputra, bodhisattva great beings should train in the profound perfection of wisdom. Then the supermundane victor rose from that concentrated meditation and said to the Bodhisattva Great Being, the Superior Avalokiteshvara, "Good, good, good, child of good lineage, it is so, it is so. In just the way that you have indicated, the profound perfection of wisdom should be practiced. Even the ones gone thus admire this." The supramundane victor having pronounced this, the Venerable Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Great Being Avalokiteshvara, all those in the surrounding retinue, and the worldly beings, including gods, humans, demigods, and aroma eaters, admired this and praised what the supramundane victor said. Drawing from a long tradition of Indian and Tibetan commentaries on the Heart Sutra, I will offer some food for thought on its central passage. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness, emptiness is not other than form. This pithy statement contains much meaning. First, all persons and things are dependent upon their causes and upon their parts, and cannot exist independently of them. They are dependent arisings. Consequently, they are empty of inherent existence. Because all phenomena are dependent arisings, they have a nature of emptiness. Conversely, as beings and things have no independent or inherent nature, they must rely on other factors. They must be dependent arisings. The emptiness of forms is not separate from forms. Forms themselves, which are produced and disintegrate due to the presence of conditions, are by their own nature empty of inherent existence. This absence of inherent existence is their final reality, their mode of abiding, their final mode of being. In sum, the production and disintegration, increase and decrease, and so forth, of forms are possible because forms are empty of self-powered existence. Phenomena such as forms are said to dawn from within the sphere of the nature of emptiness. Consequently, the Heart Sutra says, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness, emptiness is not other than form. In this way, emptiness and dependent arising are shown to be in harmony. In brief, forms are not empty because of emptiness. Forms themselves are empty. Emptiness means not that a phenomenon is empty of being some other object, but that the object itself is empty of its own inherent existence. That a form is emptiness means that the final nature of a form is its natural lack of inherent existence. Because forms are dependent arisings, they are empty of an independent, self-powered entity. That emptiness is form means that this natural lack of inherent existence, which is the absence of a self-powered principle, makes possible the forms which are its sport, or which are established from it in dependence upon conditions. Since forms are the bases of emptiness, emptiness is form. Forms appear as like reflections of emptiness. In my own experience, it is easier to understand that because things are dependent arisings, they are empty of inherent existence, than it is to understand that because things are empty, they must be dependent arisings. Although intellectually I know the latter very well, experience on the level of feeling is more difficult. Nowadays, I often reflect on a statement in Nagarjuna's Precious Garland. A person is not earth, not water, not fire, not wind, not space, not consciousness, and not all of them. What person is there other than these? First, Nagarjuna considers whether the physical elements of the body, earth, which is the hard things, water, which is fluids, fire, which is heat, wind, which is air, and space, which is the empty spaces such as the gullet, could be the self. Next, he examines consciousness. Then he considers whether the collection of all of these could be the self. Finally, he rhetorically asks whether the self could be other than these. In none of these ways can the self be found. Then Nagarjuna does not immediately draw the conclusion that the self is not real. Rather, right after that stanza, he says that the self is not non-existent, but is a dependent arising, which is dependent upon the six constituents. Then, based on this fact of dependence, he draws the conclusion that the self is not real. He says, due to being set up in dependence upon a composite of the six constituents, a person is not real.